Good evening, everybody. I'm your host on Valley Writers Read, Franz Weinschenk, here to introduce a wonderful and very successful Valley writer, Gary Soto. Gary was born and educated right here in the Central Valley. He has written numerous books of prose and poetry, and we just know you're going to enjoy five of his short stories from mainly a book of his entitled A Summer Life. I'll be reading the first story, and it's entitled The Haircut. Then Travis Sheridan will be reading a story called The Nile, followed by Judy Ryan reading The Pie and Don Weaver reading The Bike. Finally, the author himself, Gary Soto, will read the last story. It's from the foreword to a volume commemorating Fresno City College's centennial and is entitled My Time on Weldon Avenue. So let's get started. Here's the first story, The Haircut.
When you get a haircut, be sure to go back home. When you get a haircut, get a barber you have known. Since you were a little bitty boy sitting in a booster chair, or you might look like Larry Moe or Curly if a stranger cuts your hair.
The Haircut by Gary Soto. Reinhardt, 12-year-old barber, dropped my mother's sewing scissors on the floor and ran out of the house, leaving me in the kitchen blinking the small eyes of a dull chicken. My hair lay in a dish towel wrapped around my shoulders and on the floor, with a few renegade strands floating through the air. I got up and I looked in the hall mirror. My new haircut had all kinds of weird angles. It parted on the right, the left, and even down the center. My scalp was bluish, with so much hair gone my nose was huge as an evil root. I'm going to get that oaky, I promised myself. I swept the floor and snapped the towel on the back porch. I chased down some floating hair strands, and I went outside to look for 'em. The sun glared on the asphalt. The street was empty of kids and dogs. Mrs. Prince was whacking a dust mop on the holly bush. I walked down to Romaine Playground, which, except around the pool, looked deserted. I borrowed Caveman's swimming trunks. He was through swimming for the day, so I decided to postpone my hunt for Reinhardt and jumped into the public pool full of 50 Mexican kids beating the blue water white. My school friend Alfonso swam crocodile style, his mouth and nose underwater and his eyes on the surface. He stood up and he asked me about my head. I explained it was my new haircut, and he ran fingers through one of the parts. I pushed him away and he returned to his crocodile swim. I stayed most of that afternoon at the bottom of the pool, avoiding my brother and sister, who had shown up with towels over their shoulders. I liked the sound of kicking legs and the dreamlike sight of other kids holding their breath underwater with eyes open and seaweed hair wavering about. I came up for air, looked around at the racket, and sank once more to the bottom of the deep end of the pool, where the water was cleaner from not being touched. Exhausted and red-eyed from the chlorine, I got out after 2 hours, changed in the gray shadows of the men's room, and returned the swimming trunks to Caveman, who was playing ping-pong with a crushed ball. My brother, Rick, already dry from swimming, looked at my haircut and he asked, "What happened?" I ignored him and I played sorry and then foursquare. Finally, a knot of hunger in my stomach, I returned home, racing from patch to patch of shade. Like a dummy, I had forgotten my shoes. I had also forgotten about my haircut. Mom was at the stove with steamed-up eyeglasses, refrying beans with one hand on her hip. Over dinner, the fog cleared from her lenses, and she asked, "What happened to your hair?" I touched the top of my head, shocked, mouth open to reveal bits of half-chomped tortilla. I remembered Reinhardt chuckling and hair parachuting to the floor. I remembered the cold scissors around my ears. Mom puckered her mouth into a butt of angry lines. She ripped her tortilla and said she would fix me later. After dinner, she cut the rest of my hair on the backyard lawn, yanked roughly at each snip, and left me as bald as the belly of a boneless chicken. I looked in the mirror and scared myself. Hate was in my heart, and I imagined Reinhardt sitting in his own kitchen with a towel around his neck. I felt better only after Mother said we were having Kool-Aid ice cubes for dessert. I sucked on 3 cherry-flavored cubes in the backyard and did cartwheels with my sister. I tried to forget about my hair. My palms tingled when I raked them over the bristles. My brother didn't tease me because he was feeling too sad about his girlfriend moving away. My stepfather, home late from work and red in the face from drinking at Uncle Tom's tavern, he grinned at me as he held on to the wall. He said he liked my hair because it made me look like a Marine. He dug into his pocket for some change and handed me a nickel, 3 pennies, and his nail clippers. His eyes floated in alcohol. He looked at the nail clippers and then said, "I got one like that." Before I got into bed, I curled 30-pound weights in the garage under the halo of a 20-watt bulb, feeling strong because a ribbon of sweat began to run from my armpits. I was sure that if my mother were trapped under a car wheel, I could save her with my leg strength. I stood in front of the mirror. My head didn't look that bad. I was as lean as Mrs. Prince's dust mop, but strong, I thought. I made a shiny muscle in my right arm and bared my teeth all the way to my gums. I ran a hand through my baldness. For 3 weeks, smooth was my favorite feeling.
When you get a haircut, be sure to go back home. When you get a haircut, get a barber you have known. Since you were a little bitty boy sitting in a booster chair, or you might look like Larry Moore Curly if a stranger cuts your hair.
That was The Haircut from A Summer Life. Next we have Travis Sheridan reading The Nile.
The Nile By 7th grade, I knew better than to spit while girls were around. I had started liking them and those little bumps behind their blouses. Their legs were still stork thin, but they were looking better all the time. I no longer acted dumb. I swallowed that lump of spit that formed in PE, feigned a smile, and walked around looking troubled because everyone had begun to perceive me as a thinker. I looked moody, but inside I was wildly happy. I was getting good grades by simply sitting up in my chair and folding my hands on the desk. The nuns were right after all. Posture could get you anywhere. Now that I was going to public school, I was in the front row studying the Euphrates. First impressions mattered a lot. My friend, Caesar, threw up eggs and civics, and because it smelled bad and lingered in the air like mustard gas, no one liked him for 3 years. I felt sorry for Caesar and for nerdy classmates who didn't catch on that it was insane to drink at the water fountain near the West Hall. That was where stray dogs lapped water. Everyone knew that, even the teachers who drank from red thermos cups. Everyone except the dips and nerds. When I was with a girl, say Rita Castro, who used to share her homework with me, I was always careful to close my mouth after I had said something. I thought it was impolite to let your mouth hang open. Who wanted to look at a tongue or crooked teeth? I was also scared that a gnat might fly into my mouth and I would choke and throw up just as some good-looking girls came into the library. After that, I would have to hang out with Caesar, who spent his recess near the backstop with 3 fat boys. I began to think that Mother was right when she said good manners were important. I began to say yes, not uh-huh. I began to walk, not run when someone called. When my aunt kissed me on the cheek, I didn't turn away and make a sour face. When my uncles, after a drinking binge, dropped on the front lawn, I no longer rained flakes of grass on their head. Instead, I peeled an orange and listened to them mumble about their lives. One afternoon, my friend Scott and I got into our heads that the girls liked having their pictures taken. With a borrowed camera, we went downtown. We didn't have film, but we thought we looked pretty smart, kneeling, one eye squinted before a rose bush and snapping the shutter 100 times. Rose bushes were one thing, girls another. When we clicked the camera at them, they hid their faces in sweaters, giggled, and ran. We enjoyed seeing them run, skirts jumping above their knees. One time we ran after them, laughing with our mouths open. Then they stopped, and we freaked out. We had to say something, and I was so scared, so shy, that I blurted out that my pants cost $7.95. Red climbed to my face, and I ran away thinking that maybe that's how Caesar felt when eggs exploded from his mouth. Neither Scott nor I was good at math. The girls knew this and fanned themselves with their B-plus quizzes. I was good at geography, though. Mr. Johnson pointed to a map of Africa and baffled everyone by saying that the Nile flowed northward. It looked impossible because, according to the map, the river flowed up, and every other river in the world flowed down. "Water can't do that," a girl remarked. Some boys shook their heads. I raised a hand and explained that Africa was mostly rocks and sand, and what looked like a flat surface on a map was really mountains. Of course, when I said this, my posture was straight and my hands were folded coolly on the desk. The teacher, Mr. Johnson, wiped his hands clean of chalk dust and smiled. I was happy after figuring out the Nile River. And during lunch, Scott and I walked around the schoolyard taking pictures. We clicked some pigeons eating toast. We clicked a bicycle seat puddled with rain. The clouds, pulled thin above the trees, seemed interesting as well. When three girls started following us, we pretended not to notice them. We busied our faces with deep thoughts and clicked a backdrop scrawled with orange graffiti. The girls watched us a while, then left. We didn't see them again, up close that is, until we were at a ninth grade dance. The one with piled hair now had short hair like a boy's. She and I danced and drank punch thick with round ice cubes. Toward the end of the evening, we escaped to the parking lot. A sweep of headlights lit up her eyes. I kissed her and left moisture on her neck. She kissed me back and told me about her family and her runaway brother. Her father was red-faced from welding and her mother jittery from flailing her hands on a stenograph machine. I said yes a couple of times with throaty conviction and asked her if she remembered how, in geography, I figured out why the Nile flowed up, not down. I told her that I was still good at geography and that I was getting good at words. I left more moisture on her neck and then breathed, "You exude feelings that remind me of Istanbul." I perfumed the air with more beauty, then called it a night with a long, long kiss.
That was The Nile, as read by Travis Sheridan. And now we have Judy Ryan reading The Pie.
So bye bye, Miss American Pie. Drove my Chevy to the levee, but the levee was dry. And them good old boys were drinking whiskey and rye, singing, "This'll be the day that I die. This'll be the day that I die."
The Pie. I knew enough about hell to stop me from stealing. I was holy in almost every bone. Some days I recognized the shadows of angels flopping on the backyard grass, and other days I heard faraway messages in the plumbing that howled underneath the house when I crawled there looking for something to do. But boredom made me sin. Once at the German market, I stood before a rack of pies, my sweet tooth gleaming and the juice of guilt wetting my underarms. I gazed at the 9 kinds of pie, pecan and apple being my favorites, although cherry looked good, and my dear fat-faced chocolate was always a good bet. I nearly wept trying to decide which to steal, and forgetting the flowery dust priests give off, the shadow of angels in the proximity of God howling in the plumbing underneath the house, sneaked a pie behind my coffee-lid frisbee and walked to the door, grinning to the bald grocer whose forehead shone with a window of light. No one saw, I muttered to myself, the pie like a discus in my hand, and hurried across the street where I sat on someone's lawn. The sun wavered between the branches of a yellowish sycamore. A squirrel nailed itself high on the trunk where it forked into two large bark-scabbed limbs. Just as I was going to work my cleanest finger into the pie, a neighbor came out to the porch for his mail. He looked at me, and I got up and headed for home. I raced on skinny legs to my block, but slowed to a quick walk when I couldn't wait any longer. I held the pie to my nose and breathed in its sweetness. I licked some of the crust and closed my eyes as I took a small bite. In my front yard, I leaned against a car fender and panicked about stealing the apple pie. I knew an apple got Eve in trouble with snakes because Sister Marie had showed us a film about Adam and Eve being cast into the desert, and what scared me more than falling from grace was being thirsty for the rest of my life. But even that didn't stop me from clawing a chunk from the pie tin and pushing it into the cavern of my mouth. The slop was sweet and gold-colored in the afternoon sun. I laid more pieces on my tongue, wet finger-dripping pieces until I was finished, and felt like crying, because it was about the best thing I had ever tasted. I realized right there and then, in my sixth year, in my tiny body of 200 bones and 3 or 4 sins, that the best things in life came stolen. I wiped my sticky fingers on the grass and rolled my tongue over the corners of my mouth. A burp perfumed the air. I felt bad not sharing with cross-eyed Johnny, a neighbor kid. He stood over my shoulder and asked, "Can I have some?" Crust fell from my mouth and my teeth were bathed with the jam-like filling. Tears blurred my eyes as I remembered the grocer's forehead. I remembered the other pies on the rack, the warm air of the fan above the door and the car that honked as I crossed the street without looking. "Get away," I had answered, cross-eyed Johnny. He watched my fingers greedily push big chunks of pie down my throat. He swallowed and said in a whisper, "Your hands are dirty." Then he returned home to climb his roof and sit watching me eat the pie by myself. After a while, he jumped off and hobbled away because the fall had hurt him. I sat on the curb. The pie tin glared at me and rolled away when the wind picked up. My face was sticky with guilt. A car honked and the driver knew. Mrs. Hancock stood on her lawn, hands on hip, and she knew. My mom, peeling a mountain of potatoes at the Ready Spud factory, knew. I got to my feet, stomach taut, mouth tired of chewing, and flung my frisbee across the street, its shadow like the shadow of an angel fleeing bad deeds. I retrieved it, jogging slowly. I flung it again until I was bored and thirsty. I returned home to drink water and help my sister glue bottle caps onto cardboard, a project for summer school. But the bottle caps bored me, and the water soon filled me up more than the pie. With the kitchen stifling with heat and lunatic flies, I decided to crawl underneath our house and lie in the cool shadows listening to the howling sound of plumbing. Was it God? Was it Father speaking from death? Or Uncle with his last shiny dime? I listened, ear pressed to a cold pipe, and heard a howl like the sea. I lay until I was cold and then crawled back to the light, rising from one knee, then another, to dust off my pants and squint in the harsh light. I looked and saw the glare of a pie tin on a hot day. I knew sin was what you took and didn't give back.
And the three men I admire most, the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost, they caught the last train for the coast the day the music died. And they were singing, bye, bye, Miss American Pie. Drove my Chevy to the levee, but the levee was dry. Them good old boys were drinking whiskey and rye, singing, this'll be the day that I die.
That was Judy Ryan reading The Pie, and now Don Weaver is going to read The Bike by Gary Soto.
Why are there so many songs about rainbows, and what's on the other side? Rainbows are visions, but only illusions. Rainbows have nothing to hide.
The Bike. My first bike got me nowhere, though the shadow I cast as I pedaled raced along my side. The leaves of bird-filled trees stirred a warm breeze, and litter scuttled out of the way. Our orange cats looked on from the fence, their tails up like antennas. I opened my mouth, and wind tickled the back of my throat. When I squinted, I could see past the end of the block. My hair flicked like black fire, and I thought I was pretty cool riding up and down the block, age 5, in my brother's hand-me-down shirt. Going up and down the block was one thing, but taking the first curve out of the sight of Mom and the house was another. I was scared of riding on Sarah Street. Mom said hungry dogs lived on that street, and red anger lived in their eyes. Their throats were hard with extra bones from biting kids on bikes, she said. But I took the corner anyway. I didn't believe Mom. Once she had said that pointing at rainbows caused freckles. And after a rain had moved in and drenched the streets, after the sparrows flitted into the lawn, a rainbow washed over the junkyard and reached the dark barrels of Coleman Pickle. I stood at the window looking out, amazed and devious, with the devilish horns of my butch haircut standing up. From behind the window, I let my fingers slowly uncurl like a bean plant rising from earth. I uncurled it, then curled it back and made a fist. I should remember this day, I told myself. I pedaled my squeaky bike around the curve onto Sarah Street, but returned immediately. I braked and looked back at where I had gone. My face was hot, my hair sweaty, but nothing scary seemed to happen. The street had looked like our street, parked cars, tall trees, a sprinkler hissing on a lawn, and an old woman bending over her garden. I started again, and again I rode the curve, my eyes open as wide as they could go. After a few circle eights, I returned to our street. There ain't no dogs, I told myself. I began to think that maybe this was like one of those false rainbow warnings. I turned my bike around and rode a few times in front of our house just in case Mom was looking for me. I called out, "Hi, Mom, I haven't gone anywhere." I saw her face in the window, curlers piled high, and she waved a dish towel at me. I waved back, and when she disappeared, I again tore my bike around the curve onto Sarah Street. I was free. The wind flicked my hair and cooled my ears. I did figure eights, rode up the curbs and onto lawns, bumped into trees, and rode over a garden hose 100 times because I liked the way the water sprang up from the sprinkler after the pressure of my tires. I stopped when I saw a kid my age come down a porch. His machinery for getting around was a tricycle. Big baby, I thought, and said, "You can run over my leg with your trike if you want." I laid down on the sidewalk, and the kid with fingers in his mouth said, "Okay." He backed up and slowly, like a tank, advanced. I folded my arms behind my head and watched a jay swoop by with what looked like a cracker in its beak. When the trier climbed over my ankle and sparks of pain cut through my skin. He backed up and slowly, like a tank, advanced. I folded my arms behind my head and watched a jay swoop by with what looked like a cracker in its beak when the tire climbed over my ankle and sparks of pain cut through my skin. I sat up quickly, my eyes flinging tears like a sprinkler. The boy asked, "Did it hurt?" "No," I said, almost crying. The kid could see that it did. He could see my face strained to hold back a sob, two tears dropping like dimes into the dust. He pedaled away on his bucket of bolts and tossed it in his front lawn. He looked back before climbing the stairs and disappeared into the house. I pulled up my pants leg. My ankle was purple, large and hot, and the skin was flaked like wood shavings. I patted spit onto it and laid back down. I cried because no one was around, the tears stirring up a lather on my dirty face. I rose to my feet and walked around trying to make the ankle feel better. I got on my bicycle and pedaled mostly with the good leg. The few tears still on my eyelashes evaporated as I rode. I realized I would live. I did nothing fancy on the way home. No figure eights, no wiggling of the handlebars, no hands in my pockets, no closed eye moments. Then the sudden bark of a dog scared me, and my pants leg fed into the chain, the bike coming to an immediate stop. I tugged at the cuff, gnashed and oil black, until ripping sounds made me quit trying. I fell to the ground, bike and all, and let the tears lather my face again. I then dragged the bike home with the pants leg in the chain. There was nothing to do except lie in the dirt, because Mom saw me round the corner from Sarah Street. I laid down when she came out with the belt, and I didn't blame the dog or that stupid rainbow.
Someday we'll find it, the rainbow connection, the lovers, the dreamers, and me.
That was Don Weaver reading The Bike from A Summer Life by Gary Soto. And finally, the last story tonight will be read by the author himself, Gary Soto. It's taken from the foreword of a volume commemorating Fresno City College's centennial and is entitled My Time on Weldon Avenue. Here's Gary.
My Time on Weldon Avenue. In summer 1973, I pushed a gas-powered mower up Weldon Avenue and stopped in front of a house with a scraggly lawn and debated where to begin. I had been hired by Fresno City College to mow 20-plus lawns, front and back, and once done to tend them until these modest houses and apartments, built in the 1930s, were torn down. Their time was up. The college needed offices and parking lots, a not unreasonable demand then, and not unreasonable now. But until its demise, the neighborhood on the east side of the college still had to be maintained. This included an apartment I called home. There, in this top floor apartment, also lived, but barely, Rick, my older brother, the artist, Donald Lee, Vietnam vet and potter, and Randy Saludis, a drummer. Our rent for the three-bedroom apartment, $75 a month, split three ways, sometimes four. I was a grateful college student. This gardening job paid $1.75 an hour, a notch better than minimum wage, which was $1.65. I had attended City between 1970 and 1972, majoring in easy classes. It was now an English major at Fresno State, and a young poet with long curls like Byron. I gave this gardening job my best. I was sort of like an Indiana Jones. To get through some of those backyards, I used a swashbuckling machete, and I swatted mosquitoes big enough to carry away small dogs. Okay, I exaggerate. But it was oily work that began early and ended early. 3 o'clock in the afternoon, when the Fresno sun had everyone praying for a new ice age. For 2 weeks straight, I fired up the lawnmower of the type which I believe to this day is responsible for global warming. That piece of machinery was a piece of garbage, but I didn't complain. I got to work cleaning up the same place where I had lived. What a deal, I thought. How many of us are lucky enough to mow his lawn and get paid for this effort? That summer, I lived on water that gushed from a hose. I was hired, I believe, in June, but Fresno City College wouldn't pay me until early July. I had to hang tough, the knots of hunger twisting in the cavern of my empty stomach. I was hungry, hot, and desperate. At the time, I didn't own a wallet, for I understood that wallets were for folks who had money. I had change, quarters and dimes, and maybe a couple of dollars in my drawer. When I learned that I would be paid monthly, I thought, gee, how do I survive until payday? As it happened, I survived on love. In one of those houses, a duplex really, lived a young woman whose beauty was like peeking into paradise and then going blind, her image forever etched in my memory. More than once, she had come over to see what we boys were doing, starving mainly, but also making music, making art, making poetry, making our own beds and lying in them. We vagabonds were living on frijoles from morning to night, and plums from the tree in the yard, and grapes from a vine that ran along the fence near the railroad tracks. "My precious neighbor," I cried into my pillow. "Would she ever look at me? Would she ever lock herself out of her house and give me a chance to use my head as a battering ram?" I would see her come and go. She had a job. She had another life. And see her wash her long white Plymouth on Saturdays. She was beautiful. She was older. And she wasn't mine. She even had a credit card in her wallet. "Oh, so that's what they look like," I remember thinking. But I dried my eyes and regrouped. I became sensible. I became convinced that she would be mine when one day I witnessed her bring a hammer down on a walnut. The shell broke like glass. She was on her porch when I walked past, me suddenly with coins in my pockets, as the college had finally paid me. I eyed her, my eyelashes no doubt fluttering, and she looked up with that hammer in her hand. She smiled and brought it down on a walnut. "Strong gal," I mused. I moved down the street to Scotty's Liquor on Blackstone Avenue for a soda and returned swinging a paper bag that contained a 16-ounce Pepsi. As a neighborhood gardener, I deserved that cold, sugary rush. I thought I could maybe impress this beauty, but how? With my wit, my long black hair and good looks, my impressively slender waist, the result not of hours of sit-ups, but bouts of starvation? I returned to my apartment that overlooked her duplex. The hammering of walnuts had stopped, and this young woman, one Carolyn Oda, was in her kitchen. I heard the stove door open and close, and I heard the whir of an electric mixer. Then I heard my heart thump as I approached her duplex. I had in mind that I could ask if there was something I could do for her. After all, wasn't I the gardener? Wasn't I responsible for seeing that our neighborhood sparkled? I climbed the cement steps, knocked, and managed to ask, "Do you need something?" Was a college boy ever so young? She unlocked her screen door. There was something I could do. I could taste one of her cookies. I tasted one and then another, and I didn't say no to a sandwich either. Later, I would visit her daily and share with her my toiling efforts at becoming a poet. She presented her refrigerator. I had never seen so much food packed into such a small space. There was the ham and cheese, the tomatoes and lettuce, jams and jellies, the ketchup and mustard, the works for a boy who had just turned 20 and still had a hollow leg to fill. I married that woman with a hammer in her hand on May 24, 1975, the night of a lunar eclipse. If the college hadn't hired me to mow those lawns, I wouldn't have known her, wouldn't be here, a poet. Who knows? I could have ended up pushing a mower in another part of Fresno.
That was Travis Sheridan, Judy Ryan, Don Weaver, Gary Soto, and myself, reading five of Gary's short stories for us. Friends, Gary has a unique way of recreating what he saw and felt as a youngster living in Fresno. When we listen to his stories, we really feel that we know what he went through after his pants got caught in that bicycle chain. We understand his confliction about right versus wrong after he took that pie that did not belong to him. He makes us understand his mindset after his buddy Reinhard gave him that awful haircut, and we empathize with him when he used his knowledge of geography to attract some young ladies. In the last story that we heard tonight, he told us about working for the newly established State Center Community College District, which ran and still runs Fresno City College, and how he met his wife. Well, he graduated from that college, and since I too have been associated with that institution, I can't tell you how proud we are of his success. As a matter of fact, if you ever get a chance to visit Fresno City College, be sure to stop in on the Gary Soto Museum, where you'll find a lot of his memorabilia connected with his writing. Thanks so much, Gary Soto, for being on our show tonight. We hope we can entice you to come back and read more of your extraordinary literary prose in seasons to come. And so we come to the end of another edition of Valley Writers Read. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to listen to tonight's or any other Valley Writers Read stories again, just go online to kvpr.org and link up with archived audio. Next week, our author will be Judy Ryan. In the meantime, this is your host, Franz Weinschenk, wishing you and yours a great life story until we meet again. Good night.
Valley Writers Read is a production of Valley Public Radio, produced by Don Weaver and Franz Weinschenk. Please join us again next Wednesday at 7 p.m. for another edition of Valley Writers Read.